This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. This is Sterling Allen, your host. You can join us online if you'd like to tune in, to call in, or to see the past lineup of speakers and the future lineup of speakers at freeenergynow.net, or you can join us every day at freeenergynews.com, where you'll get the latest on the breaking technology developments in the field of new energy. And today our guest is Peter Lindemann, Dr. Peter Lindemann, who has been for 30 years studying how to make electric motors more efficient and possibly even harness some unseen energy. I've known Peter for quite some time, almost from the beginning of my foray into a new energy, which has not been nearly as long as what Peter's put in. He recently produced a DVD, a 2.5-hour DVD called Electric Motor Secrets. That was published a story about that DVD at ZP Energy, where we linked to that in our news. And part of that story is talking about a 100-mile-per-gallon car, just modifying a low-weight vehicle with a diesel engine, a torque converter. And we're going to talk about that as well as electric motor secrets. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sterling. It's an honor to be on your show.
Thank you. Well, let's talk, like I said, about that 100-mile-per-gallon car, because I think that is a good springboard as an analogy to the electric motor concept that we'd like to go into in some depth. How do you turn a vehicle into a 100-mile-per-gallon car?
Well, certainly there's a lot of ways, and probably most of the information in the public domain at this point has focused on trying to do things like vaporize the gasoline and maybe water injection and other things that are fairly significant modifications to an engine and how it runs. And these things are pretty much outside of the capability of most people. And they also change the performance of the engine, make it run hotter, colder, different things. So quite often people who try these experiments end up with a damaged engine. The idea that I proposed in my latest free energy update news service was a very, very simple idea, and that is to just put in a small EPA certified diesel engine, little three-cylinder diesel engine that put out about 22 horsepower, and then connect that to a variable speed torque converter. Now, these little belt drive torque converters are typical of the types of transmissions you see in a lot of the ATV all-terrain vehicles or snowmobiles or even the skidoo type of jet ski devices. And all they do is they create a continuous ratio change of the gear ratio between the engine and the load. So, and they automatically pick the one that allows for the maximum energy transfer. So typically your average car, even a big Cadillac or something like that, doesn't really require very much energy to go down the road. All you have to do, Newton's first law of motion says that all motions are conserved. In other words, once something's going, once a motion is set in place, you actually have to apply energy to stop it, and this is what's called inertia. So once the inertia of the car is at 70 miles an hour, then literally all you have to do is overcome the wind resistance and the bearing drag on the wheel bearings and overcome the friction of the drivetrain and things like that, and that only represents between 10 and 15 horsepower for the average car. So believe it or not, the only thing it takes really to go down the road, even at highway speeds, is somewhere between 12 and 15 horsepower. So so the idea is that a 20 horsepower engine is sufficient to create that, and all you need to do, typically larger horsepower engines are needed for cars because you don't want to take, you know, half a minute to get from 0 to 30 miles an hour. That would be dangerous in traffic, you know, stop and go traffic and things like that. You want to be able to accelerate at a reasonable rate quickly, and that's what takes more horsepower usually. But with these torque converters, the way you would drive a vehicle like this is that it's pretty much all or nothing as far as the engine goes. You just floor it, you take it up to its speed where it produces 20 horsepower, and then the torque converter lets out the gear ratio and the car accelerates quickly. So it's a you know, there's a slightly different method of driving, but you can get 60 miles to a gallon in town and probably 90 to 100 miles per gallon out on the highway. And so, you know, it just depends on what you want.
So in this scenario, you're starting with a low-weight vehicle, or are you talking about taking your existing vehicle?
Well, the thing is that the fundamental idea will work with any vehicle. You know, if you've got a big Cadillac and you want to try in this, then probably a 20 horsepower diesel wouldn't be quite sufficient, so you might want to kick it up to 30 or, you know, maybe even 40 horsepower, but you'd be taking out a 250 horsepower engine that's going to, you know, use a whole lot more gas. So instead of getting, maybe 15 or 20 miles to a gallon with your Cadillac, maybe you could get it up to, 60 on the highway and 45 on, in traffic. The idea can be applied at almost any level to get better mileage and not sacrifice performance, really.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we look at this idea, obviously there's going to be some nitpicking things that we could talk about for an entire hour, and that's not our purpose today, such as, you know, how do you retrofit a drivetrain and front-wheel drive versus rear-wheel drive, et cetera, mm-hmm. make it compatible. You know, all those questions are not really necessary for our purposes right now. The idea is very simple. You replace a heavy engine with a lighter engine. You sacrifice some performance in long-haul uphill pulls or in acceleration to a certain extent, but you still have a functional vehicle that can give you freeway speeds on straight stretches or level stretches, I should say. And basically, it's not a huge expense. It's a reasonable retrofit that a reasonable mechanic could handle.
Exactly.
The point is that these vehicles that we have driving down the road, that we kind of picture the auto manufacturers know what they're doing. In reality, what they're doing is they're giving us what we ask for, which is a lot of power and a lot of bells and whistles. What we deliver to the U.S. market is much more beefy than what is over in the European market and other markets of the world where they get by on much less. And I think there's an analogy we can make here to your electric motor approach. If and it's actually very somewhat of a weak analogy in terms of the extent that we're talking about, where our perception is that these motors that we have in our fridge and our escalators, you know, et cetera, that are, you know, making our civilization work. I mean, we have motors in our printers and in our hard drives. You know, motor everywhere we go nowadays, including in our vehicle, the windshield wipers. You know, the motors are everywhere. And an efficient motor nowadays is in the range of 95%. At least that's what we're told. And what I understand in your presentation in this DVD that I was able to watch this last week, that 98% or 95% efficiency is actually based on the configuration of the typical motor. And what we would like to talk about in this segment is there are ways to actually do a different configuration where we can get many times more, not just a few more percentage to get closer to 100% efficient. We can actually do several times more efficiency in using electrical energy to produce torque output by approaching the engine design in a different way. Let's talk about that.
Okay, that's a good place to start. Basically, right now, almost every motor out there, essentially, we'll just say every motor that's available today, and we're talking about electric motors here, not gas engines or anything like that, just so the listening audience is very clear about what we're talking about. Every electric motor that is sold commercially today is based on an experiment that was originally performed in 1831 by Michael Faraday. And what he did was he found, and this was a big discovery at the time, and it shouldn't be minimized, but he found that if you take a wire and put that wire in front of a magnetic, in front of a permanent magnet, for instance, and then you apply an electric current to that wire wants to move out of the field, and it moves sideways out of the field. And it's a very interesting effect. And what he also found was is that the effect was reversible. In other words, if you simply move the wire in front of the magnet, it will generate electricity. And so this was the original discovery of what is called direct electric induction. In other words, how to induce an electric current in a wire when you didn't have it from a battery in the first place. Now, in 1831, this was an astonishing discovery, and the effect is it works in both directions. In other words, if I put electricity into the wire will create a physical force and move itself out of the magnetic field. And if I move it, if I put a physical force on the wire and move it through the field, then it will generate electricity. So these two phenomena are kind of two sides of the same coin, for instance, okay? That literally. And because it's the same thing. You have a wire moving in front of a magnetic field. Now, all the motors and generators that are built today are based on this idea. And when you're running the thing as a motor, it also causes this generator effect. And this is what's called the back EMF. And in other words, what was discovered was that the ability of the wire to produce mechanical energy produced a physical force in one direction, but it also, when the wire moved, it generated an electric current, which was in the opposite direction of what you were putting into the wire to make it move in the first place. So the idea that this functions as an electric motor and that it functions as an electric generator, these two functions actually oppose each other in the same machine. And this is what's called the back EMF, or the counter electromotive force. And so what's been discovered is that these two things kind of work against each other. And this is why in all the big power stations we have to, you know, build a bigger and bigger engine to drive the generators when we want to light our light bulbs. Because when that current moves to light our light bulbs, it creates a force back at the generator station that makes the generator harder to turn. This effect is happening in every electric motor.
Yeah, if I can interject here, what you're describing here, from what I understand, is very well known and understood and documented extantly in the existing literature. Back EMF is essentially a law of nature that the engines are working against, and so when we're talking about a 95% efficiency, it's with this back EMF baggage included.
In true, exactly. And
what you're going to tell us, you're going to describe what this back EMF is and how to remove it from the equation and therefore take that obstacle out of the motor. So it's not violating laws of physics, it's working around certain laws which are detrimental to efficient motor paradigms.
True. But let's take a look at that specific issue, okay? Because right now, the physicists will tell you that the first law and second law of thermodynamics have set the conversion rate between electrical energy and mechanical energy production, like what you get in a motor, you put electricity in and you get mechanical energy out, and that the electric motor is supposed to convert the electricity into mechanical energy, and that conversion process is determined by the first law of thermodynamics, which sets that conversion rate. And so this is what is currently believed in the physics departments, okay? And what's been discovered is that that may not be true. That may be a misinterpretation of that energy conservation rule. Because if you change the way the motor is designed, for instance, if we use something other than Faraday's original experiment to produce mechanical energy, and one very simple thing we can do is we can just create an electric magnet, which is just a coil of wire around a piece of iron. So when we put electricity into that, it will produce a magnetic field in that iron. And as long as we do anything except move a wire in front of that, then we can get around the problems of the way the standard motor works. So, for instance, if all you do is when you turn your electric magnet on, if you just ask it to attract another piece of iron that has no electric characteristics at all. In other words, it's just a physical force. You know that a magnet will attract a piece of iron, and any magnet will, whether you create that magnet with a small electric current in a coil or whether you use a permanent magnet. Everybody's pretty familiar with the fact that magnets will attract iron.
Right.
So what we can
do... Will there be any... In that scenario, will there be any eddy currents?
There would be.
Iron?
Yeah. Yes, in other words, all of the standard rules apply to this situation. However, since there are no since these field effects are happening relatively slowly, those eddy currents do not constitute a huge loss. In other words, yes, if I turn the magnet on and off and attract the iron and then pull it away when the magnet's off and then attract it again and then turn the magnet off and let it fall away and so on and create a cycle where I can do this, that piece of iron that I'm attracting and letting go may warm up some, which is what the eddy currents will do. In other words, there will be energy lost in the process as heat. And so that's a standard kind of thing that is well known how to overcome if you make it up of very thin slices of iron which are insulated from each other the way they build transformers and other things, then you can minimize those effects, but still have the benefit of this other design.
Mm-hmm.
So
and
the losses in that
scenario are much less than the back EMF that we're talking about.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's important that to understand that there is no back EMF in that situation. In other words, whereby the regular induction method, if I move a wire in front of a magnet, I can generate electricity, or if I put electricity in front of the wire, through the wire in front of the magnet, it will create a physical force. But in this new situation, if I move my iron piece closer to the magnet without putting any electricity into it, it doesn't generate any electricity. So just moving the iron piece mechanically doesn't create any electricity generation. So the machine, first of all, is just a motor, and it's not a generator. So first of all, we have an energy transfer system that goes from A to B, but it doesn't go back from B to A. And that is the beginning of opening up a completely different window of opportunity, we can call it, that will behave differently than the direct induction motor.
The example you give in your DVD, I think, is excellent, that kind of brought this to my attention and made it really comprehensible for me, is you know, when you apply electricity to a motor, the motor turns. The opposite is when you turn the motor, a typical motor, it generates electricity out those same wires.
That's true.
So a motor can serve as both a motor and a generator, depending on whether you're putting electricity in or whether you're turning the motor to generate current out. And the fact that you can turn that rotor and create electricity, you think in your head, well, if I'm putting electricity into this thing and making that thing turn, what you're saying is that it's creating a current, which we call back EMF, which is fighting against the forward motion of that motor. And that just, that explanation really helped me comprehend, you know, what we're up against with back EMF. So go ahead.
Well, yeah, and that's the exact thing. See, what most people don't understand is that the standard motor, when you put the electricity into it, it's literally doing two things with that electricity, and this is what most people don't understand, is that it's producing mechanical energy, which is what you want it to do, but it's also generating electricity, and it's applying that electricity against what you're putting into it. And so that the effect of what you're putting in is diminished by how much electricity it generates back at you. And so the idea is that if you build an electric motor that doesn't have this second process, in other words, that it doesn't generate electricity when it turns because it is turning, then you can get the same kinds of mechanical energy production with much less electricity input, because you don't have to constantly overcome the electricity that it's generating against you. And so this creates a much more interesting situation that appears to allow you to make much more mechanical energy for a much smaller amount of electricity than the currently believed laws of physics would allow. And yet it's not a very unusual arrangement. It's just an electric magnet attracting a piece of iron. So this is not esoteric. It doesn't take special materials that can only be made in an atomic reactor or something else, you know, or you know, a special alloy that only can be made in a special factory. We're just talking about a motor that's got copper wire and an iron core, which is about as normal and ordinary as you can get.
In fact, one of the key principles, talking about simplicity here, that you have in your design, in your this DVD that you give out, the Lindemann solenoid motor, uses John Bedini's principle, where while you're turning a rotor, you can both be putting, you're putting in energy and you're getting out almost as much energy into a separate system. Rather than fighting back, you're actually harvesting that, for lack of a better term, the back EMF is, rather than fighting and going back into the input, is actually being dumped into an output for a very efficient conversion. And, you know, as you know, we did an open source project on the Bedini simplified motor, which still gets a lot of attention on our PES Wiki website. Mm-hmm. People replicating that, you know, I built one, my mother-in-law built one. It's easy to build, and you integrate that principle into this design of yours, and yours doesn't go much more complex than that. Not that it's going to be really easy to build, but still, we're not talking about, you know, rocket science type of thing. It's just more like the farmer common sense sometimes trumps the rocket scientist.
Yeah, basically has been discovered, and most of this stuff was all worked out by a brilliant electrical engineer back in the 1970s named Bob Teal. And even though his patents don't describe these things, we have a video of Bob Teal demonstrating his motor, and he understood all about recapturing the electric input from his system, as well as producing very high mechanical energy from it. So just to describe this to your listener, the sequence of running a motor like this is very simple. You have a coil of wire and a movable piece of iron. And then around the coil of wire, you also have an iron jacket, which is called the magnetic keeper. In other words, what we want to do is we want to keep the magnetic field that's generated by this coil in a very concentrated area. And so what happens is you can turn that coil, that electric coil on using a battery or some other source of electricity. And what it will do is it will attract a piece of iron up into the center of that coil. And the movement of that piece of iron into the center of the coil will produce mechanical energy. And then you can turn the coil off, and when that magnetic field collapses, it will generate an electric pulse back, which can be captured in a second battery or to use for a second use, like light bulbs or other things, which is what Bob Thiel demonstrates in his little demonstration. But the Bedini SG motor group that that you were a part of, that collapsing magnetic field was again captured as an electric impulse output that was used to recharge the battery. And you saw that it could easily be set up to recharge the second battery up to about 90% of what was being drawn from the front battery, right?
Yeah, it was really efficient.
Yeah, it was pretty good. So, I mean, you could put electricity in and get about 90% of that electricity back, so that basically your net loss was only about 10% of what you were really using. And that methodology of conserving the electricity has been really well worked out, and those circuits have been all over the internet now for many years, thanks to your build groups, and that's pretty much all over the place now. So,
thanks primarily to John Dini.
Absolutely, because he wanted people to understand these processes. He not only patented them, but he also wanted people to understand them. So we have a great debt of gratitude to John for wanting to publish this material. And now we're getting back to the second part, which is how to get more mechanical energy out of that process when we do that. And John's little motors were primarily designed to create this kickback that would charge the batteries, but because he was using relatively weak ceramic magnets and other things, the amount of mechanical energy that you can get from the little schoolgirl motor designs is not very much. And so now going back to Thiel solenoid motor designs, where you just turn a coil on and attract a piece of iron, if you configure that properly, you can get much more mechanical energy produced while still getting between 85 and 90% of the electricity back. And now all of a sudden, a whole new set of possibilities arise for the production, for the efficient production of mechanical energy. And in both of these situations... Go ahead.
Yeah, I should just interject here that the scenario you just described is actually a combination of three individuals. Bob Thiel for the coil attracting the iron into the middle of it. John Bedini for harnessing the output so that you have an input of electricity, and then you can actually grab the output and use it rather than having it fight against you. And then you for combining these two ideas. That wasn't something that Bob Thiel did. He didn't harvest that output electricity, did he?
Yes, he did. He knew all about it. And even though he doesn't discuss it in the patents, and he doesn't discuss it even in the literature that I have posted on my website, if you do watch the what's being shown as the missing Bob Thiel interview, which we've also got links to on my page, you can clearly see that he talks quite a bit about recapturing that impulse, and he shows the motor lighting light bulbs without slowing down and other things like this with the captured energy. So clearly Bob Thiel did understand all of the mechanisms, even though he didn't describe how to do these things in his patents. So really what we're just trying to get back to is a very simple and clear understanding of what Bob Thiel had fully developed but didn't fully reveal. But now by going back methodically through all these things and understanding John's very simple circuitry for the recapturing of that, and then understanding how to maximize the mechanical energy production using just this piece of iron being attracted to an electric magnet idea, we can get to a place where a very, very efficient electric motor can be created that seems to use very little electricity, and this seems to violate all kinds of things. You know, if you just go back to the theories of conservation and, you know, that it takes 746 watts to make a horsepower, you know, and things like this, this motor seems to violate a whole lot of things. It just doesn't seem to behave along those rules, which is very exciting.
Yeah, it is. Let's back up in history a little bit. You were involved in a laboratory in California several years back, a couple decades ago, and you had a working motor that was implementing some of these principles.
Yes, we did.
You know, it wasn't without its problems, but you have had five. Well, let's explain that. And let me, I would also, before you go into that explanation, just want to give you some kudos and a little bit of a backdrop for this whole interview that we're having with you here today. You know, for our listeners, we're talking to Dr. Peter Lindemann. He's been at this for 30 years, and this has been his passion. If you Google free energy, this is the site that comes up, much to my chagrin, because we own freeenergynews.com, and Peter Lindemann's site almost always comes up before ours, and we have a lot of content on our site. For whatever reasons, there's a lot of people that link to Peter Lindemann's book, Secrets of Cold Electricity, something like that. Isn't that the title of your book?
Yeah, the Free Energy Secrets of Cold Electricity. Yeah, the discussion of how Ed Gray built his engines back in the 70s also.
Really an interesting book that's gotten a lot of people interested in the field in general. And so Peter Lindemann and free energy go hand in hand in a very corporal sense. And, you know, you go to Google and Peter's the first site that comes up. That's a really incredible accomplishment. And this isn't just in the last few months. It's been ever since I've been on the net looking things up. You know, free-energy.ws is your website. And that's, you know, that. So that's a real feat. And the kudos part of this, besides the fact that you're doing really well in Google, which is an indication of how significant your work is also, you know, you don't want to see the work that you've done go to the grave with you. It's not like you're getting up in the years. You still have a lot of years with us, I hope.
Let's hope, yes.
You've seen too many people with an untimely demise, you know, walk away from this planet without letting us know how they did what they did, and you don't want to see that happen. So you have disclosed all, essentially, in this DVD in terms of saying, here's what I understand about the electric motors, and here's how we can get, and I'm quoting from your website, 35 times more energy. I mean, that is such an amazing number. I mean, maybe there's, you know, and actually, if I understand right, that's using some conservative figures.
Yeah, so, I think that, you know, certainly that would be the upper limit of, I mean, if we could take an ordinary electric motor and get a 35 times increase in its efficiency, that would, I think, be pushing the upper limit of it. And certainly that sounds extremely exciting, and I agree with you there. But even if these principles are, you know, imperfectly brought into manifestation with various designs, the idea of getting 10 times more out of the electric motor seems relatively straightforward and should be able to be practiced by quite a number of experimenters if they would get in there and slowly work out the details. So,
and you do have a discussion list on linked from your website, where
true.
And the DVD that you sent me had a little URL at taped to the front of it, where you can go join this discussion list of people who are replicating this information, sharing what they learn, and kind of trying to reproduce what you had accomplished in some new iterations that you've come up with of how to improve on what you had back in California. So now, with that little bit of introduction, let's talk about California. What did you have there?
Well, I was introduced to the work of Bob Teal in 1979, and all of those documents, which I've just put on my website, are from that era. I moved to Santa Barbara at the invitation of Bruce De Palma in 1982, and started studying with him. He was certainly one of the most brilliant people in this field while he was alive, and his unfortunate and untimely death in 1997 was a great loss to this to the free energy movement on the planet. He was a brilliant, brilliant man. And he really taught me how to think about these things and helped me kind of loosen my my thinking, you know, as far as how big the box was that I could think in. And he once said that the only thing I believe in is God, and everything else must be proved. And so even the most you know, sacrosanct ideas, such as the laws of conservation, such as you know, the laws of thermodynamics. There are many examples in history where these supposed immutable laws have been proven to not apply in certain specific situations. Laws of thermodynamics are violated by Wilhelm Reich's orgone accumulator, where the box just warms up even though no work's being done due to the accumulation of some environmental energy, which he called orgone. Tesla published on being able to build an ambient heat engine, which he calls the self-acting engine, back in the year 1900. He said it was possible to run an engine from heat that was gathered from the ambient air temperature, and it would produce refrigeration as a secondary byproduct, and you could get mechanical energy out of it. And I know that Ken Rowan is trying to duplicate things along this line as well. And
we have a story in our news today about something along those lines.
Exactly. And but thermodynamics would say that that's not possible. In other words, once you're operating from a you know, a reservoir of heat, once you get down to the ambient, then they say, you know, the conventional wisdom says you can't both refrigerate and extract the energy at the same time. In other words, you have to do work to move off the ambient. And Tesla was adamant. He said, no, you don't have to do work to do that. You can actually extract work. And so there have been multiple brilliant people out there who have routinely said, look, there are big holes in these supposed immutable laws, and we can drive trucks through them if we engineer it right. And some of these you know, magnetic attraction motors with the electrical recovery processes, when you put all of these things together, it seems to open up one of these windows that's so big you can drive a truck through it.
Right.
So that's
really
very
quickly,
exciting.
Yeah, let me interject here. This story I just mentioned is actually going to be in tomorrow's news. Edwards Hot Water. The Edwards heat pump is like a solar. This is a product you can buy now. This is not theoretical. This is not research and development. This is something you can put money down and buy. It says it's like a solar water heater without collector panels. It operates like a refrigerator, only in reverse, transferring the heat in the surrounding air to the stored water. It is extremely energy efficient, using approximately one-third the energy of a conventional electric water heater.
Super. I'm so happy. This is fantastic. And this is exactly what we're talking about, so you can have a hot water heater, you know, an electric hot water heater now that saves you 66% of the electricity that you would normally have to put into your electric hot water heater. And actually, probably if you put even a little bit more insulation around that, you can even, you know, lower how much you have to put in even more. And so this is the other thing that I'm starting to talk about on my website more. I'm about to put up a whole new website. And we're going to be talking about the use of free energy in a whole new way based on our idea of conserve and use natural energy first, kind of a philosophy. So if we use more insulation for heat management and things like this, and then so we lower what our needs really are, if we use compact fluorescent lights so we don't need as much electricity to get lighting, or if we use LED lighting and things like this, so if we conserve and just lower our use, and then all of a sudden, if we want to produce what little we need left from alternative sources, now that's much more viable. So, in other words, if I need 12 kilowatt hours of electricity a day to run my house, buying enough solar panels to do that is pretty expensive. But if I can lower my electric needs by a factor of, say, 75%, then I only need to buy 25% as many solar panels to generate that need, and now all of a sudden solar is starting to be cost effective. And so what we're trying to find a way to do is realize that a combination of being very, very efficient in our energy use without wasting energy, and starting to transition to these renewable sources like solar panels and other things. We're at the stage where we can move to alternatives, and without lowering our lifestyle back to some caveman idea, or simply going without. We don't have to do either. We can transition
even
now,
to the point where alternatives are actually starting to cost less
exactly
than the conventional.
Mm-hmm. But even so, we have to stop wasting. Yeah, let's go back to California. In 1983, I started working with a machinist, a really brilliant guy named Michael Knox, and he had built a number of machines for Bruce De Palma during some of his funded periods. And Michael and I decided to start working on some generator designs that I had proposed back in the early 80s. And these were generators that produced electricity with no back EMF. So the idea of producing electricity from a machine that was just a generator and wasn't a motor. So we'd been working with that. And when we really started looking very carefully at what Teal had done, we decided to also try and build a type of an electric motor that wasn't a generator. And so we came up with this machine that I show in the DVD called the Flux Motor. And what it was a series of electric coils that all faced in towards a rotor that was made out of plastic that had just 5 bars of iron in it spaced evenly around. And it had 4 electric coils facing in, so there was an interface between 5 pieces of iron in the rotating section against 4 big electromagnets on the outside. And so these things were staggered in their alignments. So you could turn on one coil and it would advance at one step, and then you could turn that one off and turn the next one on and it would advance at another step. And so it took 20 on and off cycles of different coils to get the rotor to turn around once. And so this, and it would start in any position, so the minute you applied the power, it would start rotating. And every time you turned a coil off, you would get that big punch of electricity back out. And this thing was, we never were able to fully test it, but it was a very, very powerful motor. It had tremendous amounts of torque. And so it did prove the point that it is possible to produce a very strong mechanical action and get most of the electricity back out. And we had an operating unit in 1983.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's amazing. You said you have since disassembled that. Do you still have that in your possession?
I have parts. I have it in parts. We were basically unfunded during those periods of time, and because we were looking at a number of different topologies that were using the same framework, we used that framework to build 3 different styles of generators and that one motor. So what we wanted to do was the generator needed to turn around 2,500 RPM, and when the motor turned slowly around 500 or 600 RPM, we kind of got a little discouraged, and then we ran out of money completely, and we all had to go get jobs and do something else. I have most of the parts. In other words, but it hasn't been assembled in operating condition for over 25 years.
From our conversation last night, this newer design of yours that you show in this DVD, and I should mention that even though you're very free with a lot of the information on your site, you also make a living off of selling some of this information, and you have a price of $30 for this DVD, which is a very reasonable price for what you're getting there. It's very well done. The explanations are very clear. Certainly worth the buck, and as you put it, it's $1 for every year you've put into your...
Exactly. So I feel I'm worth at least a dollar a year for the work. So... Because I do, because I present it as well as I can, and I feel like researchers who buy this, can literally jump to right to where we are with this, and jump right into the benefits of everything I've learned in 30 years. So, it's definitely worth it.
You were mentioning with this five rotor. Iron pieces with four stator coils, you had tremendous wear on the bearings as it would pull one direction, then the other direction, another direction, and that this newer design is balanced so it would not have that kind of wear on the bearings. So even though you had a lot of torque, it wasn't necessarily a feasible design in terms of...
Well, it wouldn't have run very long, yeah. In other words, it would have... See, and that's the whole thing, that these types of ideas of just turning a coil on and attracting a piece of iron, these were the very first motors that were ever developed after Joseph Henry invented the electric magnet back in 1821. And so even before Faraday figured out this other induction method, people were starting to build electric motors by turning on a coil and attracting a piece of iron. And there were problems, and I go through this in the video, talk about the history of these things, and the difficulties of getting a lot of mechanical energy out of these things because of the geometry of the parts. And finally how Teal solved these problems to get a lot of mechanical energy out. So again, each one of these things, people just go to a store and buy something and they expect that it's all worked out. But when you're researching these things, nothing is worked out, and every little variation has to be tried before the best designs emerge from this research. That's why they call it research and development. And as Ken Rowan said in a recent post, research means to search again. So these things have to be looked at and looked at and looked at again to before they're fully understood. And
I think it's great that you're, even though there's a charge for this DVD, you are putting information out there. You're not going the typical route of first developing and getting a patent on it and nailing it down. Not that you may not eventually be able to do some of that, but you want to see this technology move forward. And so, this is your way of getting it out there and getting some research and development muscle going in basically, for lack of better terminology, the open source community.
Exactly. Well, I don't know how many people of the listeners out there have seen Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth. But it's a very, very important document. And in it, he makes a very strong case for... what I would call the moral imperative that we stop polluting the planet. And whether you believe that carbon dioxide is a pollutant, or whether you believe just that the other combustion products are a pollutant, or all of these above things are a problem for the planet. And I do believe that all of them are a problem. And I take on that moral imperative personally. And I know that if we can come up with electric motors that draw less energy, then we can burn less carbon fuel, and that will help us all. And so that's the reason I'm putting the information out, Sterling.
the corollary of that is more bang for your buck, too. I mean, if you're getting 35 times more energy or more torque out per electricity in, that means a much smaller motor to accomplish the same output. So it's both a conservation, and there are also some other possibilities in terms of if we could maybe delve just for a brief moment about this whole back EMF thing and where the energy just disappears according to modern calculations. They don't adequately account for where that energy goes, and the corollary of that is if they have energy, quote, disappearing in their present setup. If we can fix the setup to a more efficient arrangement, then that energy can, quote, reappear in what some people might call free energy.
Well, yes, and again, this is a controversial thing because right now the conventional wisdom says that you have to put 746 watts into an electric motor to create a mechanical horsepower. And what my analysis shows is that very possibly there's a reasonable argument to suggest that something like 75% of that energy just disappears into the motor and doesn't give you anything for it. And of course that's a very, very controversial analysis. Okay, that's not the conventional wisdom or the conventional explanation of what happens to the energy that you put in. But I think I make a pretty strong case for saying that that's a possibility, which is our motivation to look at other topologies and realize that we can actually produce more mechanical energy for a smaller amount of electrical input in the first place, as long as we get around or just don't invoke this back EMF process. And in fact, that is what shows up. But again, if you don't start with the right question, then you don't look for the right answer. So that's one of the reasons why the front end of this starts with very standard motors and very standard processes and very standard analysis, until we get to the point where the anomaly shows up, and then I point it out. Mm-hmm. So,
and even then, you stay fairly conservative in your presentation in the DVD. It was only in a conversation with me on the phone that you ventured a little bit, and you didn't necessarily want to go into that in this interview, and I respect that. But I wanted to at least just put a little teaser out there, since our audience does include some people who are very forward-looking, outside the box, just to wet the whistle a little bit.
Yeah, I think there's if these things are looked at closely, with a fresh eye, and with the hypnosis, part of the mental processes, unplugged, and we look at these things dispassionately, some very, very exciting possibilities arise very quickly, and that have very, very startling and unconventional explanations. And I think that's the simplest way of putting it.
Yeah.
Without sounding like a quack.
One of the things that's exciting about this is that the field of electric motors, as you mentioned in your movie, kind of has backed out of academia because it's kind of viewed as old hat, old science. Now they're looking at computer science, and the interest is in some of these more, let's talk about nanotechnology. What is the cutting edge? They feel like electromagnetic motors is beating a dead horse, and you're saying not
exactly.
So.
Exactly, and that's all I'm trying to do. Some of the brightest minds in the last 20 years have gone into software, development, and that's why we have, these astonishing things happening in computer science. And what I'm saying is no, we need to go back over a lot of these things, like heat pumps, like electric motor design, like electric generator design, because there is another whole wave of development here. We've been through a couple generations of computer development, and certainly IBM and the big mainframes and all this kind of stuff, you know, really dominated the first wave. But then, you know, as soon as the graphical user interface and the mouse control and all this kind of stuff took over, then this explosion of small computers, you know, just took over in the last 20 years. And then, of course, you know, the ability to share files from university to university or from, you know, military base to military base and the old, DARPANET, you know, and then all of a sudden somebody puts a graphical user interface on it and creates the World Wide Web, and look at where we are. So this whole second generation, you know, created this monstrous leap from the original developments. And what I'm saying in this video is, look, there is that second big step we can make in electric motors and electric generator designs, and it's just waiting to happen, and we should start looking at it.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's been a wonderful talking to you. It's been a classic interview. I appreciate you coming on the show today. Your website is free-energy.ws. And people can go there to purchase your DVD under products and other things that you have available there. You can join us every day at our freeenergynews.com. And Peter, I appreciate the support you've given of that. You're one of our kudos. You have kudos on our site. I appreciate that.
I look at your site every day. It's one of the best sites on the web. And I go to BBC and I go to your site to find out what's going on. So I mean that's my daily plug-in. So keep up the great work.
Well, I appreciate that, and good luck in this endeavor. Hopefully this interview can help spur additional interest. Certainly this is just the beginning of a 30-year quest. It'll be interesting to see this mushroom. Thank you again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.